Okay. Everybody awake? I suspect we'll have people trickling in all through class along the spectrum of I overslept a little bit too. I forgot to change the clock. But that's fine. So we are wrapping up the Minor Prophets today. And we will be really time to start now. And so I want to try to tie together some of the things we're seeing in the Minor Prophets and sort of explain why we jump straight from the beginning of the Old Testament to the end. And I think by the end of the class you'll be able to see some logic behind that and some useful tools as we move forward into the middle of the Old Testament. So our objectives for today are to be able to list three characters from prophecy whom the Jews of the first century were anticipating in a messianic context. That's part of tying all of this together and setting the stage for the middle of the Old Testament. To name four important messianic images from the book of Zechariah, and to explain the importance of the Minor Prophets in general, and Zechariah in particular, to the cohesiveness of the messianic image of the Old Testament. We'll review these at the end and we'll see how we do. So if you remember from the first class, we talked about these periods of messianic prophecy, which are really only separate in terms of how the picture of the Messiah in prophecy is developing. It's not like, you know, somebody in the divided kingdom woke up and said, okay, it's time to change our view of the Messiah. But as God's revelation came and we look backwards through it, I think we see these kind of three periods, points of clarity in the overall picture. So by the time we get to the Minor Prophets here at the end, most of the major images have been introduced. You can see that in this chart. And the emphasis, especially from our perspective looking backwards, is going to be on connecting the dots and filling in the details rather than on introducing brand new images. You also see, a little bit of an aside, in the prophets, you see things that formerly had been types or foreshadowing brought into focus as prophecy and given more meaning and detail. But for most of the images and prophecies in the Minor Prophets, the image has been introduced somewhere else. We'll look at King and Prophet and the Victorious Supper today, all of which are introduced back in Genesis, as we have seen in the first two classes, but now are being expanded on in order to help Israel be prepared for the coming of the Messiah. And it's important I think I said at the beginning, to sort of try to understand what the original readers would have understood these prophecies to mean. But it's also important, I think, to understand what the Jews of Jesus' time would have been looking for in the Messiah. Because that helps us understand why Jesus says the things he does, why he explains prophecy the way he does in the New Testament and the apostles as well in the book of Acts. So let's talk about that for just a second. When the Jews looked backward through history, through prophecy, they saw three key characters of the person of the Messiah. The first is the King. That's the word Messiah, the Anointed One. This was the descendant of David who was going to sit on the throne and reign over God's people from a restored Jerusalem. And you know some of the prophecies about this. I tried to pick the ones that are kind of specifically and obviously about each of these three characters and not sort of vague and then applied to them later. So, for instance, Micah 5, we talked about that one last time, right, that in Bethlehem this king would be born and he would rule over the peoples. That's very clearly the point there in Micah 5. One of the ones we didn't get to talk about last time that I wanted to look at just briefly is Amos chapter 9, verses 11 and 12. And this is a prophecy about the reign of the Messiah and his kingship. In that day I will raise up the fallen booth or tabernacle or shelter of David and wall up its breaches. I will also raise up its ruins and rebuild it as in the days of old, that they may possess the remnant of Edom and all the nations who are called by my name, declares the Lord who does this. Now what's interesting about that one is that it's clearly messianic. I mean, it talks about David. Even in the original context, people would have understood he's talking about the Messiah, this anointed one. But in Acts 15, James applies this to the church and to his sort of work in the world. And that's not surprising. I mean, it's clearly about the Messiah reigning over the nations. You know, it says that explicitly. What is interesting to me is the translation. If you look in Acts 15, this is the conference at Jerusalem, and James says, so James is going to sort of prove from Scripture that the Gentiles are supposed to be equal members, equal citizens in the kingdom. And he says in verse 15, with this the words of the prophets agree, just as it is written, after these things I will return, and I will rebuild the tabernacle of David, which has fallen, and I will rebuild its ruins, and I will restore it. And we think, okay, yeah, good, I recognize this from Amos chapter 9. Verse 17, so that the rest of mankind may seek the Lord and all the Gentiles who are called by my name. That's not what Amos 9 says. It talks about they may possess the remnant of Edom. Right? What's happening here, and this is common enough that it's worth talking about in the New Testament, James is quoting from the Septuagint, which is the Greek translation of the Hebrew Scriptures. It was prepared sometime before I think it's the 2nd century B.C., 1st century B.C., I don't remember the dates offhand. It doesn't matter. Anyway, he's quoting from that version of the Greek, of the Old Testament, from the Greek Septuagint. And the point is that the Greek, or the Septuagint, sometimes rephrases things. But the fact that James quotes it, I think, demonstrates that it doesn't miss the point of the passage just because it doesn't translate that part about Edom. So here's part of the point of the Messianic image, or the Messianic kingdom, is that it's going to bring all nations together. Specifically, it's going to bring God's promise to Abraham to full fruition, which would include bringing back in the offshoots of the Abrahamic line that were not a part of that original promise, which would include Edom, who are the descendants of Esau, right? So you see that what the Septuagint did in that translation was to say, what's going on here is God is restoring all of the Abrahamic line back into the full covenant relationship that they had before they were separate nations when they were all just Abraham. And the Septuagint captures that, and James, in quoting that passage, I think emphasizes there in Acts 15 that that is what God is doing. He's bringing all of these nations back together into the Messianic kingdom. Yes?
So I just make sure I understand. So you're saying that the Septuagint translators, when they saw that, and having had the time realizing that wasn't very messianic, that they chose what was really a more messianic translation of that verse?
I think so, and I think that was partly occasioned by the fact that by the time you get to the time when the Septuagint was put together, Edom as a nation was basically gone.
Yeah.
So I think they would wrestle with, well, who is he talking about then? And I think they probably just understood that, okay, in the messianic context, he's bringing all the nations together, and that would include the other descendants of Abraham who had been excluded from the Messianic promise by virtue of their ancestors are now being brought back into it. And I think that's the choice they made.
Yeah, and I think that's interesting. I hadn't realized that. Because, I mean, you really think of Edom as being really, it's going to get worse at the time when Jerusalem's destroyed, but even in the days of Amos, the concept of Edom was, them people.
Yep, yep.
So, okay, that's interesting.
I can't prove that.
No, but I think
so. Anybody who wants to disagree is fine, and I won't argue. Yes.
I thought the word Edom in Hebrew is related to the word Adam for humanity.
It is, and I think that's a part of it.
Okay.
But the choice of Edom there in the context of Amos, I think, is intentional. It has to do with their antagonistic relationship with Israel. So, like I said, I think both translations, both in the original Hebrew and in the Greek, make sense in the context of their creation. But I wouldn't argue that double meaning is not intended by Amos. Does that make sense? Like, I think it's very possible that he's playing on the word there to mean both these enemies that are going to be brought into the Messianic kingdom, which is a clear part of the Messianic image, restoring the nations and bringing them into subjection to God, but also extending to all mankind, which is actually what the second part of that verse said, all the nations.
Yes.
So, like I said, I'm not gonna argue for it real strongly. But I think that might be what's going on. But we'll look at Zechariah 6 in just a minute, but that the idea that this king, the anointed one, is also a priest, is an important part of the Messianic image. And note in this context the precedent of Melchizedek, right, is a king and priest. But it's not just Melchizedek. It's also we'll come back to that. We'll talk about that in a minute. Get into heaven. So the next person of the Messiah is the prophet. This is a fulfillment of Moses' prophecy in Deuteronomy 18 of the one who revealed God's will as Moses had, meaning, I think, from a face-to-face relationship with God, not simply one who had heard it and passed it on, but as Moses did, spoke to God face-to-face and revealed him to the people. And that's the context of the promise that Moses makes in Deuteronomy 18. Is, remember, you said you didn't want to listen to God directly, so I had to go talk to him. And God's going to send someone else like that. In Malachi 3 and 4, further details about this messenger that we'll look at today, that he would precede the Lord coming to his temple. We'll talk about what that means and whether that's the Messiah or not. And that Elijah the prophet will restore families and ward off destruction. By the way, we'll talk about that. Some interesting things going on in Malachi. And then the third person that they would have been anticipating is the sufferer, or we sometimes call him the suffering servant. It's the one who would be punished for pursuing God's truth and justice. This is a major character in the book of Isaiah, and we'll look at that when we get to Isaiah later in the class. But there are other images that are kind of fit this mold in the other prophets, but it's really not until you get to the time of Christ that the idea of the sufferer in Isaiah, who is clearly messianic, is expanded to include the other sufferer people, the other sufferer images, in some of the other prophets. And so, for instance, in Luke 24, Jesus says, all of the scriptures said that the Christ would have to suffer. And I think to Jews in the first century, they would have gone, well, I know Isaiah says that, but is it everywhere else too? And so that's part of what Jesus is trying to explain it. And we'll see that in Zechariah, both the description of the sufferer and then how it's applied to Jesus in the New Testament. So, the advantage of studying the last prophets first, I think, is that we see these images and some others we'll look at today very clearly because they're fully described for us. This is like the clearest image we have of them in the minor prophets. So we've seen the kind of the vague, shadowy beginnings in Moses, and now we're going to look at the really clear, obvious descriptions of them in the last books of the Old Testament. And I think doing that, those signposts at the beginning and end, will make it easier for us to find those images as they occur in more or less vague descriptions in the books in the middle. So that's kind of the logic for organizing the class this way. It makes it easier for us to look for them in a more subtle form in the texts in between. So that's what we're doing. Now, one quick point about these three persons. It was not clear to Jews of the first century, before the time of Christ, and even after, that these were going to all be one person. And in fact, if you read the history of the Jewish people in the, for instance, the Maccabean period, they would appeal to passages like these to prove or reject someone's claim to be the Messiah. So, for instance, when the Hasmoneans claimed the throne, as they claimed to be the Messianic lineage, people said, yeah, but you're not born in Bethlehem, so you can't be the Messiah, right? So they understand that this is these passages are about the Messiah. They're anticipating these three characters, but they don't necessarily understand that they are going to all be one person. There is some there are some people who kind of say, well, yeah, the Messiah is going to suffer, and the king should also be a prophet and some other things. But the idea that all of this is talking about one person is something that was not fully clear to them, and that was a large part of Jesus' message. Yes, the Messiah must suffer at the hands of unrighteous men before he comes into his glory. And we'll see some of that wrestling as we get into Zechariah in particular. Okay, so hopefully you look through Zechariah a little bit. It's one of the longer minor prophets, but the lesson kind of helped, I hope it helped you see the important passages for our class today. What images of the Messiah did you find in the book of Zechariah? What's the really obvious one?
Priest.
That wasn't the one that I was going to get. Yeah. But, okay, that was in there too. Good.
Keep going, guys.
But no, that's good. So we got the priest, we got the shepherd. What else?
King.
The king. There's one more.
God calling all nations together again.
Okay, that's certainly a messianic element that is present in Zechariah, but I'm looking for an image of the Messiah.
The branch.
That's the one I wanted to start with. That's the one that's kind of unique to Zechariah. It isn't unique to Zechariah. What is unique about it in Zechariah, I should have said, is that he takes this idea of the branch and begins to tie these other roles into that image. So it's a reintroduction of an established character from Isaiah and Jeremiah. This one who would be a descendant of David, Isaiah says, you know, he grew up like a shoot out on dry ground. And this branch will grow from humble beginnings to do great things. So in Zechariah 6:12, we have the a man whose name is Branch. He will branch out from where he is, and he will build the temple of the Lord. We'll talk about that a little bit more in just a second. But the idea of branching out from where he is means, he didn't sort of grow up in a place you would expect a king to be, sort of branched sideways into it. Which is not a statement. It is really a statement of the humble birth of Christ more than, like, he wasn't the Messiah and then he grew into it or something like that. We have to be careful about reading too much into these images. But so that's the character. But here's the thing about Zechariah. As I've already said, he doesn't just say, here's the branch again. He actually says, here's the branch, and the branch is also the priest. So in chapter 3, when the branch is first introduced, is in the context of this vision of Joshua the high priest, who stands before the Lord bearing the sins of the people, these soiled garments, and the angel tells the other attendants to take the robes off and put festal robes on them. They'd be the priestly robes that were appropriate for a day of festival. Specifically, I think the Day of Atonement is what's in mind here. And one commentator says in verse 5, when it seems to be pretty clearly Zechariah who says, let them put a clean turban on his head. Zechariah gets so fired up with this atonement that's going on that he can't resist saying, he's got to wear one of these too, you know. So he's got the high priestly robes on, and Zechariah gets so excited. He's like, give him the hat. And so they do. I think it's a good lesson for us to be that excited about atonement as well. But this branch who is the priest is the fulfillment of the type of Joshua. So in verse 8, that Joshua the high priest and you and your friends who are sitting in front of you, indeed they are men who are a symbol for, behold, I am going to bring in my servant the branch. So they represent the branch and the work he will do. He will be the means of defeating the accuser, Satan, verse 2. And this is significant, the work of atonement will be accomplished in one day. One of those kind of oddly specific things that you kind of think, is that like apocalyptic language? You know, is it like figurative, apocalyptic, or is it literal? Not really sure in the context. But you get to the New Testament, and sure enough, the work of atonement was accomplished in one day. That's a significant detail of this vision of the branch, who is the priest, atoning for the sins of the people. And then the third image is that this priest is then made a king. And I think it is significant that he is made a priest first, and then he becomes a king. He, as the king in chapter 6, he's going to build the temple of the Lord. That is a kingly function, because remember who built the first temple?
Solomon.
Right. And David prepared it. So that building temples for the Lord is, in the Israelite tradition, a kind of a kingly office. He's going to rule on his throne, verse 13, a kingly thing to do. And it actually says in verse 13, thus he will be a priest on his throne. These two roles are being blended together. And note in this context, the precedent of Melchizedek, this is what I started to say earlier, the precedent of Melchizedek being both a priest and a king, but that precedent is not limited to Melchizedek. There are other examples of the king functioning in an intercessory role in Israel's history, specifically David. You'll remember, this is kind of the most obvious one, or the one we know the best too. The plague, when David decided to go count the men of Israel, and he went out and offered a sacrifice at the threshing floor of Araunah. That's David acting in an intercessory. He's doing a priestly job there, right? He's offering a sacrifice. He's interceding between God and the people so that to bring God's mercy to them. There are other examples too. Hezekiah and Jehoshaphat both kind of act in intercessory roles. And then, of course, there's the statement, which we'll look at in a future class, in Psalm 110, you are a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek, in the context of a description of the king there in Psalm 110. That had to mean something to Israel, right? We'll talk about what that is, but I just want you to see that this idea of the king also being a priest, having a priestly or intercessory role, is not something that just pops out of nowhere when you get to Hebrews. In the New Testament, that it was there from the beginning, even though it was not necessarily the king's most obvious role. It is part of what it's supposed to do. Yes.
Going along with the Hebrew idea of the branch, in Isaiah 11, the Hebrew word for branch is different than in Jeremiah 23 or the words that are used in Zechariah.
Yeah.
So in Isaiah 11, I believe that's the first time this idea of Jesus being the branch is used.
Yeah.
And the Hebrew word is Sheresh,
yeah,
which people think is related to the word Nazareth, that for like when Matthew 1:2 says that he's going to be a Nazarene,
yeah,
that it's related to these ideas of him being the branch.
That's right.
So
yeah, and we'll explore that when we actually talk about Isaiah. But having said that, I do just want to make the other side of the argument that even though it's a different Hebrew word, it is still clearly the same character.
Yeah.
In Jeremiah and also here in Zechariah. But yeah, that's a good point. I think we'll explore that when we get to... I'm teaching two of the three Isaiah classes, so I'll tell you, we will explore that when we get to... But you probably noticed I didn't actually finish... So he's going to rule on his throne. He will draw other nations to build the temple. That's interesting that his job is to build the temple, but he's also going to bring other nations to help with that, both as a sign of their subjection to him and also of this kind of unification of the nations, to go up, as Isaiah and Micah say, to go up to the house of the Lord. And he's going to put them to work in it. But this king will enter Jerusalem humbly on a donkey. And, of course, this passage is significant. It's quoted in the New Testament in the triumphal entry, that, you know, your king is coming, O Jerusalem, on a donkey, on the foal of a donkey. So here's the thing. I mean, yeah, donkeys are humble, right? But they are also, there's some hints that they are also a symbol of triumph. Maybe because donkeys are really bad for fighting on, because they're not fast, they're not big, they're not strong in the same way that horses are, right? So if you're riding a donkey, that means you're pretty sure that things are peaceful. So there's this idea, and you can see it most clearly in Judges 5:10 in the Song of Deborah, that riding on a donkey means that you won. And so maybe that's a part of what Jesus is doing when he rides a donkey into Jerusalem. And I think it's also a part of what Zechariah is describing in a messianic context here. That this king's rule is so secure, he doesn't even need an army. He doesn't need horses. He can ride a donkey because God secures his kingdom. Yes.
I don't know if this is a part of that would you say, I was reading about that horses, usually war, the idea of a horse is war horse, that you're coming for war, and on a donkey, peace. But you're expanding it like, it's already, I'm so confident
that's one way of reading it. I mean, you could also say that one of the things God had told the kings of Israel not to do was to acquire and stockpile horses, right? Mm-hmm. So the tradition of kings riding donkeys is in some ways a kind of a symbolic representation of their reliance on God. That we're not going to stockpile horses, and I'll prove that by riding a donkey. Mm-hmm. But it shows up in Judges already, and not in a king context, and just in the context of, in the Song of Deborah, of victory, riding on a donkey. So I think it's a very complex image, and it's not used a lot in the Old Testament, which is why there's some sort of room for speculation, which is lots of fun, but also not always profitable. But I do think that's part of what's going on, both in this context in Zechariah and in its fulfillment in the triumphal entry.
And, you know, the part of the power of that is, I mean, you have this prophecy, and as Jesus is entering, and people, they're realizing.
Yeah, they understand it.
They understand. Yeah. What's going on here?
And I think, so along with some other ones that we've seen, like Micah 6, born in Bethlehem, like this is one that's so clearly messianic. Everybody knows the Messiah will come into Jerusalem on a donkey. If he's on a donkey coming into Jerusalem, it must be the Messiah. You know, it's that clear to them. And so, since it's that clear, it's one of the ones I think we need to have a clear understanding of in order to sort of build this image of Christ as the promised Messiah. But you'll notice that I didn't read all of verse 13 when I read part of that a minute ago. He will build the temple of the Lord. He will bear the honor and sit and rule on his throne. Thus he will be a priest on the throne, and the council of peace will be between the two offices. So, what does that mean? What does it mean that the council of peace will be between two offices? So I'd like you to turn to the person next to you and talk about this for just a second. Brainstorm some ideas. You should also look at Zechariah 3, verses 9 and 10, and chapter 6, the next two verses, 14 and 15, for some better, for some more clues. So take just a minute to do that.
Yeah.
Okay, I heard somebody say that makes sense, so clearly somebody's got an answer.
Let's find out.
So whoever was the recipient of the that makes sense comment is now obligated to tell us what they found. Larry's looking at Barry. Barry, is that, do you have an answer?
No, clearly was not me. She's the one with all the wisdom.
We discussed that.
Okay. Thanks for acknowledging your lack of participation.
It's a thought. He said Jew and Gentile.
Bringing those two together.
But I didn't say that made sense. So,
the two offices would be Jew and Gentile?
Right.
Okay. I think in the context, the two offices are the priesthood and the kingship. Right?
And that's what I told Barry.
That's why I voted for you. All right, but what do you think is going on? Yes.
Is it the two tribes? Because Jesus was from David's tribe, which was the tribe of Judah, and then the priest had to become from the tribe of Levi, and that threw a massive monkey wrench.
So that is certainly a part of the kind of uniqueness of this king, right, is that he is blending together these two offices that had been the specific obligations of two very different tribes,
church
right?
And state.
I think that's a part of the background. What we're interested in, maybe I haven't made clear, is what is Zechariah saying is the result of this king's reign, that when he says the council of peace will be between two offices?
Right. I didn't get it. That makes sense. But what I was thinking of was, for there to be peace, you need both the priest and the king. One forms that reconciliation or that bringing together of the two parties, God and man, and then you have the king to then rule over that and to then maintain that peace moving forward. So the two offices bring together that peace.
And so, what happens when both of those offices are the same person or done by the same person? What?
I said extra peace.
Yes, that's right. It's even easier. Because you don't have disagreements about, like, what's the peace. Yeah, exactly. Right? Yeah, I think that's exactly right. So the best way to have peace is for the king and the priest to be the same person. The king, this is what David is pointing out, the king destroys all the enemies who surround the nation by God's help, making peace in the land. That's what verse 15 is about here in chapter 6, right? Those who are far off will come and build the temple. That all the nations around are going to be in subjection. They are actually going to come and help to worship God. But the priest destroys the ungodly influences out of the land and offers atoning sacrifices, making peace with God. In chapter 3, they will remove the iniquity of the land in one day. Right? And what's the result of removing the iniquity in the land is peace in the land. In that day, declares the Lord of hosts, every one of you will invite his neighbor to sit under his vine and under his fig tree. So you have peace with God, peace with those around, and it results in peace in the land for everybody. So I think, David wins. But I think that's what Zechariah is promising here, that because those two roles are occupied by the same person, they are in perfect agreement with one another, and that peace is as perfect as it will ever be.
The thing, though, is that if you look under the Old Covenant, it was set up that those were two very different roles.
That's right.
But that this New Covenant, which fortunately we have a good explanation of that in the New Testament, that,
yeah,
hey, this has to be a New Covenant, that they then come together.
That's right. But I think that's also why it's important that there is that precedent, not just of Melchizedek the person, but also of the kings of Israel acting in an intercessory role, to kind of foreshadow and say, hey guys, like, this shouldn't have been that big of a surprise. It is a change, which the Hebrew writer makes very clear, and that was a shock, but it's not that big of a surprise because there are other people who were kings who functioned in this role.
Well, the point that he made about Jesus as far as being a priest, he said, well, you know, the connection there is about the covenant. Say, where he couldn't have been, you know, it's not talking about
right.
this old one.
Right, exactly.
So it had to be because of this new one, because of the old one he couldn't have been.
Yep.
So he is confirming and at the same time saying that there is something new and different in it.
That's right. Okay, so we talked about the king in Zechariah. Now let's talk about the next person of the Messiah, the sufferer. One of the features of the later prophets like Isaiah, Micah, Daniel, Zechariah, and Malachi, is that they are much more explicit in their messianic prophecies. They're very clearly saying this is about the Messiah or his kingdom, and it's only about that. It's not about Israel, and you know, there's no king in Israel at this point. So any points about the king are clearly not a description of the physical king of Israel. They have to be talking about somebody else. And that does make it a little bit easier to read, which is nice because Zechariah is one of the hardest books in the Old Testament. Which, by the way, if you disagree with any of my interpretations of Zechariah, you're probably right. So I'm not going to argue. But there are some things I think that about the sufferer that seem pretty clear in Zechariah. So there's this really interesting image in chapter 11. Zechariah sees himself as an unjustly treated shepherd. And I use that word advisedly, sees himself, because it's not clear whether he's actually doing this in the mode of, you know, some of the prophets who were commanded to go out and, you know, eat this way or lay on your side or, you know, go get a pot and break it. It's not clear whether he's told to go do this physically or if he just sees a vision in which he is a shepherd. There's enough weird things going on that it could be a vision, but there's also some things that seem to be saying this is a public demonstration. So, again, whatever you want to think about this, I'm not going to disagree with you, but anyway, the point is, he sees himself in reality or in a vision as an unjustly treated shepherd over a flock that's doomed to be scattered and whose owners and shepherds don't care about them and abuse them. They basically say, well, they're going to be killed anyway, so let's just treat them however we want. But Zechariah goes out and cares for the flock. He even cares for the weak and the sick, verse 7. Verse 7 is an odd verse. I'm arguing that it's saying that he cares for all the flock, even the weak and the sick. But eventually, it becomes clear that God's favor has been removed from this flock, and Zechariah says, well, there's nothing that I can do about that. And so he abandons his post, and he kind of shows that God's favor has been removed by breaking his shepherd's staff, which he has named favor, which helps us understand that God's favor has been removed. That's in the signpost. So then he receives his wages. He goes to the owners and says, pay me what I'm worth. And they give him his wages, 30 pieces of silver. Now that's significant because that's the price of a slave who's been gored by a bull, not the price of a shepherd who's taking care of a flock. You can go look at Exodus 21:32 for that. So in other words, they're saying, you know, we're going to pay you, you know, the minimum we can get away with for the work you've done. It's a sign of their disfavor towards him, their disdain for the work that he's done. And so, God says, I love this. There's one of those where you're like, okay, that's clearly sarcasm. In 11:13. Then the Lord said to me, throw it to the potter, that magnificent price at which I was valued by them. Sarcasm. That's sarcasm in the Old Testament. From God, no less. But anyway, so he throws his wages into the temple as a public demonstration of his rejection by the owners, and also his rejection by the flock is pretty clearly implied as well. And so then in Matthew 27, the 30 pieces of silver that they give Judas when he betrays Jesus is not just a more than coincidental detail. Look, 30 pieces of silver in Zechariah, 30 pieces of silver in Matthew. Therefore, it must be prophetic. It's way more than that. It's way better than that. It's a symbolic rejection of God's chosen shepherd in both contexts, right? God says, here's the shepherd. And not only the flock, but the owners of the flock, the people who were supposed to be responsible for caring for them, say, no. We don't want that shepherd. We're going to get rid of him, and we're going to pay 30 pieces of silver to get rid of him. And that's the importance of this prophecy. Not simply that there's a detail that matches in the New Testament, but it fits the type, the underlying narrative of God's people rejecting all of those whom he sends to care for them. And so in verse 13, the confusing Hebrew is rephrased in the Septuagint to give them for the potter's field, which is the translation that's quoted in all of the Gospels to explain the you know, how Judas went and hanged himself, and the high priest took the 30 pieces of silver and bought the potter's field, and they used it to bury strangers in. So that's all based on the Septuagint translation. The best explanation that I've read is throw it to the potter is roughly equivalent to, it's some kind of colloquial expression, but it's roughly equivalent to like throw it to the dogs or throw it out in the street or something like that. It's worthless, just get rid of it. But the New Testament picks up on that potter image, which I just wonder if they were like, potter? What? What in the world? And then kind of all makes sense when the actions of the last week of Christ's life conclude. But I don't know. Like I said, Zacharias. That's the end of that vision in chapter 11. But Zechariah comes back to this image of the shepherd in chapter 13 because Jehovah declares that his shepherd, his associate, he calls him, in 13:7, will be struck with the sword and the sheep will scatter. And this prophesies Jesus' death and his disciples' reaction. You probably noticed I've avoided saying that anything prophesies anything else when I've been teaching. That's intentional. This is also intentional. I think this is clearly a messianic prophecy, and I think even in the context, people would have understood that. Because Jehovah calls the shepherd his associate. This is one who is equal to me, my co-worker in this action. That the associate will be struck with the sword, and the sheep will scatter. I think that's as clear as it can be, direct prophecy of what's going to happen to the Messiah. I guess I should say one other thing about the Septuagint thing and the 30 pieces of silver. We're not really looking necessarily for like a one-to-one correspondence with New Testament stories. We're looking for a reuse of language and images. I think it's worth pointing out that in this case, it's the righteous sufferer who throws the 30 pieces of silver into the temple. Right? But it's Judas, the one who betrayed the innocent sufferer in the gospel accounts, who throws the 30 pieces of silver. That's not a problem. In most cases, the prophecies are not intended to be a minute-by-minute narration of what's going to happen in the future, although that does happen occasionally, but that's not the norm. We're looking for languages and images to be reused, and that's why it's important to examine things like the 30 pieces of silver in their original context and see that it's more than just a detail that gets picked up. It's actually a very highly symbolic action. So this is the sufferer. I want to move and talk about the third person of the messianic expectation, which is the prophet. And to do that, we're going to look at maybe the most famous prophecy about that prophet, which is Malachi chapters 3 and 4. So, in the context of Malachi, God has been criticizing Israel for their injustice and hypocrisy, expressed in numerous ways. And this discussion ends in chapter 2, verse 17, the end of the chapter, by Malachi quoting the people as his kind of form is in this book. And they say, well, where is the God of justice? Okay, we're not doing what we're supposed to do. Well, God's not going to do anything about that, is he? Well, in response, God promises a three-step judgment. First, his messenger will come and prepare the people. That's Malachi chapter 3, verse 1. That's one of the ones that we're very familiar with. I'm going to send my messenger. He will clear the way before me. The messenger will come and prepare the people. Second, another messenger will come. A messenger of the covenant will come like a refiner's fire and like launderer's soap. The fire is a common image of God's judgment. I like the image of God's judgment being like launderer's soap. Right? It's like the strongest cleansing solution you can think of. It's going to get it as white as it will ever be. But anyway, that image is only used a few times in the New Testament. So this but it is a different messenger. Chapter 3, verse 1, I'm going to send my messenger, and he will clear the way before me. And the Lord whom you seek will suddenly come to his temple, and the messenger of the covenant in whom you delight, behold, he is coming, says the Lord of hosts. It's a different messenger, right? This messenger is the messenger of the covenant. He's going to come to judge Israel for their sins, but to give them time to repent. That's verses 5 through 7 is the description of that judgment. But it's a judgment that is in the future. Verse 6, for I, the Lord, do not change, therefore you, or sons of Jacob, are not consumed. And you think of passages where Jesus said things like, the words I speak will judge you in the day, right? Jesus came to expose the sins of the world and to, of course, redeem us from them, but also to give us time to repent before the judgment came. And that's the messenger that Malachi is talking about. Now, there's this interlude in 3 verses 8 to 18, I think it's an interlude, where you have two responses to this pronouncement of coming judgment. One response is to deny any wrongdoing, especially of the things they've been accused of. And that's verses 8 through 15. And I mean, when I read that, I just can't help but see the reaction of the most of the Jews to Jesus' teaching. We haven't done anything wrong. We have Moses. We have Abraham as our father. You know, we've never been in bondage to anyone. Who are you? You know, you were born entirely in sin. That kind of thing. I think it just sounds like verses 8 through 15. But there's a second group in verses 16 through 18 who hear this. They kind of get together and they determine to serve the Lord. And Malachi says, you will be remembered and spared. A book of remembrance is written before him for those who fear the Lord and who esteem his name. They will be mine, says the Lord, on the day that I prepare my own possession. So, that's the interlude. The messenger comes, says judgment is coming, and you have a chance to respond. Two responses, reject or accept, disobey or obey. And so the third step in this judgment is that God will destroy the wicked and save, or the language used here in Malachi in chapter 4, is heal the righteous. And as a result of that, Malachi urges two applications on his readers in verses 4 through 6 in chapter 4. The first one is to remember the law of Moses, which really means obey the law of Moses, not just, oh yeah, the law of Moses is there. And second, look for Elijah, the messenger who will precede the day of judgment. And I want to say this, we're going to talk about this, but John says he's not Elijah, which is the language of Malachi 4. But Jesus says John is Elijah. So how do you reconcile that? I was going to have you wrestle with it, but I'll just tell you. You'll get off easy today. The Jews in John 1, where John says he's not Elijah, seem to be operating under the assumption that the Elijah of Malachi 4 or 5 was the Elijah of 1 Kings, literally reincarnated. That Elijah would come back to life, and that was the sign that the Messiah was coming. John's saying, I'm not Elijah. Not that I'm not the Elijah, but that I'm not Elijah reincarnated. It was more important for John to do his work of preparing for and identifying the Messiah, which is what his job was described as being in Malachi 4:6, than to clarify exactly how to understand Malachi 4, verse 5. Jesus, however, did clarify that understanding in the context of his work of judging and giving people time to repent, to say, no, John was Elijah, he came, and they did to him whatever they wanted, just like they will do to me, to bring judgment on themselves. Okay, so next time we will pick up with the major prophets. Thanks for your attention.